Donc, merci beaucoup à tous ceux qui sont restés. Et bienvenue, welcome to all those who've just arrived. So I am going to switch to English now, even though I think Rob might give part of his talk in French. No?
Non. After all this
time, tant pis pour nous. So I just want to thank Rob for coming to give this closing seminar of my lectures and opening keynote for the epigenetics course. It's always a huge pleasure to have Rob Martinson here. He always gives incredibly insightful talks, I feel. And this year, the topic, I think, was more than relevant because I've been desperately trying to communicate all that transposons might be doing for us. And I don't know how much I've succeeded. But so Rob is a geneticist by training who has performed some of the most seminal studies in our understanding of how heterochromatin is dealt with, set up, the role of transposons, the process of RNAi, and how using a number of different organisms, so starting with maize, actually tobacco before that.
No, maize.
Always maize. and overlapping with Barbara McClintock, as I pointed out at the end of my lecture. So starting with maize and then moving to Arabidopsis and also in yeast, so in Pombe. And so he's been able to, I would say, touch on many, many different aspects of the processes of epigenetic silencing, transmission, and the molecular pathways involved. So I don't actually know what he's going to talk about. It says bad karma in his slide, for which please forgive him. He does actually think karma is a very good thing. So I don't know if you're going to talk about bad karma, but if you are, it's a fascinating story, and it fits perfectly with what I've been talking about for the last month, and I think will be very inspiring to the epigenetics course as well. So Rob, without further ado, thank you very much for being here, and we look forward to hearing you.
Well, thank you, Edith. It's always fantastic to be here. It's a really amazing building, and always fun to teach in the course, so I guess this is like a joint double duty for me. So I'm going to tell you about transposable elements and about how we think about transposons. But I'm going to talk about them very specifically in the context of germline reprogramming and epigenetic inheritance, which in many ways are guided by transposons. At least that's the way I like to think about it, and I will try to persuade you that that is in fact the case. Transposons, of course, as you know, were first discovered in maize. This is an ear of corn, of maize, that we have preserved at Carl Spring Harbour. It's actually one of Barbara's original ears that she had kept, because it demonstrates the very first transposition of the DS transposable element. And I'm not going to illustrate genetically how it does that, but it's a very clever experiment that uses the color of the corn kernels to determine the position of the DS element and shows that that had changed. So, of course, famously, Barbara was associated with the discovery of something that people then started to call jumping genes, right? And the whole remarkable ability of genes to change their order on a chromosome, which, of course, was heresy to most geneticists at the time, became how people remembered Barbara's discovery and transposable elements. But in fact, when she discovered them, she didn't call them transposable. And transposition to her was not a big surprise. And in fact, she worked with Lewis Stadler on X-rays and followed the work of Hermann Müller very closely, who had been able to move genes around using X-rays. And so, of course, you know, to her, transposition was perfectly normal. What she thought was really important and exciting was that these transposons could regulate genes. And they did so in a way that we would now call epigenetic. So what did she mean by that? It turns out that in essentially all organisms, from bacteria through yeast to plants and animals, and probably humans, transposons can influence the expression of a neighboring gene. And they do it in a way that's inherited from cell to cell in a lineage-dependent fashion. So this is not like a developmental regulatory factor that, for example, would only turn genes on in the skin or in the brain or something like that. This is actually inherited on the chromosome from one cell generation to the next. And in fact, in plants, amazingly, it's also inherited into the following sexual generation as well. So the progeny will often inherit these epigenetic changes, what we would now call epigenetic changes. And these are just some examples. This is from the mouse, where an LTR retrotransposon of the IAP class is integrated upstream of the agouti gene. And when it gets demethylated, when DNA methylation is lost, so there's no change in the DNA sequence, it's just the chemical modification itself of DNA, then you get this brightly yellow colored mouse. And in fact, this is associated with all sorts of horrible things like obesity and diabetes. It's actually a very important gene. But when it's methylated, it gets silenced again, and you get a normal mouse. But what's interesting is that you get every possible gradation in between, where you have these clonal sectors of coat color, where you can really see that this phenotype's been inherited. This is a typical example from plants. There are literally thousands of these in plants. This one is a DNA transposon that's upstream of a gene that's required for flower color in Japanese morning glory. And so you get these beautiful sectors, in this case, again, where the methylation has gone down, just like the agouti case. This is a case I actually worked on an awful long time ago when I was a postdoc in Berkeley. This is a gene in maize that has a transposon inserted actually into the upstream region. And in this case, interestingly, when DNA methylation goes up, the gene is now expressed. And that's probably because of some sort of chromatin effect. So the important thing is that each of these has a similar property, which is that the gene expression is either on or off, and sectors of the leaf in this case, of the flower in this case, or of the coat in this case, inherit that change. They change from on to off, if you like. And this is what excited Barbara, and that's why she called these elements controlling elements. And she saw them as really important agents of development and of evolution because of this. Okay, well, we now know, and actually Barbara was the first to propose, that transposons actually make up a really large part of the chromosome and also very important parts of the chromosome. Back in 1951 and 1954, she proposed, on the basis of some genetic experiments and on what she could see in the way of rearrangements down the microscope, that actually transposons were related to heterochromatin specifically, and that heterochromatin might be thought of as being made up of transposons. In fact, she referred to transposons as little pieces of heterochromatin that were too small to be seen under the microscope, but which could regulate genes and were scattered along the chromosome. Heterochromatin, we know from the work of Hermann Müller, for example, in the 1930s in fruit fly, can regulate genes, the famous position effect variegation in fruit flies. The X chromosome, X inactivation, is probably closely related to transposons as well. And of course, there are many, many phenomena in yeast. This is actually from Pombe, the other organism that we work with. So heterochromatin then, if you don't know what heterochromatin is the part of the chromosome that stays tightly condensed throughout the cell cycle. So it never unravels. Most of the chromosome arm will unravel after mitosis, and genes can be expressed. At least that's the simplistic idea. But heterochromatin doesn't unravel and is thought to be basically silent or inert. It was first discovered, actually, or at least it was first named in plants by the botanist Emil Heitz. Now that we've sequenced a lot of the genome, we know that heterochromatin is indeed loaded with transposons, much as Barbara would have predicted. Interestingly, they tend to be retrotransposons, but both types of transposons are found in centromeres. Heterochromatin turns out to be highly polymorphic. In fact, it was Barbara herself who first figured this out in maize, and she used the fact that different strains of maize have different heterochromatin located at different parts of the chromosome. She was able to use that to trace back the origin of maize to the central highlands in Mexico. And as I mentioned before, gene silencing seems to be mediated by heterochromatin in a way that's very reminiscent of controlling elements. Finally, pericentromeric heterochromatin tends to have LTR retrotransposons. But telomeres can actually have non-LTR retrotransposons. I hope by now, if you've been to Edith's lectures, you'll know the difference between an LTR and a non-LTR retrotransposon. This will become slightly important later on. So very important parts of the chromosome then. Pericentric meric heterochromatin, which of course is required for chromosome segregation, and telomeres, which are required for the integrity of the genome to protect the telomeres from the famous end replication problem, are both probably derived in some way from transposons. Even reverse transcriptase in us looks a lot like reverse transcriptase from a non-LTR retrotransposon. All right, so what do we mean about when we talk about epigenetic inheritance and transposons' role in it? Well, epigenetic inheritance is actually not a new concept particularly. Plant biologists have been thinking about it ever since genetic inheritance was first rediscovered really in the early part of the last century. And in fact, this led Luther Burbank, who was a famous plant breeder and a very important socialite, who had some very interesting friends, including Frida Kahlo, the famous Mexican artist. It led him to the proclamation that heredity was only the sum of all past environment. He didn't believe in genetics at all. He thought that, you know, as Frida Kahlo, actually this is a posthumous portrait of Luther Burbank. It's a very, very famous picture. And, you know, she sort of illustrates this with his dead body contributing to the next generation in this way. Of course, Luther was wrong. Genetics really does work. But epigenetic inheritance really is quite common in plants, and probably some of the things that had led breeders to this assumption were examples of epigenetic inheritance. It took another 50 years for Barbara and also Alexander Brink to demonstrate formally that epigenetic inheritance really did happen in maize, and happened a lot, and often involved, or maybe always involved, transposons. The reason that it's very controversial in animals is because epigenetic inheritance is much more difficult to demonstrate. I mean, it has been demonstrated. It's been demonstrated in certain model animals like C. elegans or Drosophila. But these are relatively rare examples. And in mammals, and especially in us, it's a very controversial topic. And part of the reason for that is that epigenetic marks, so the silencing of transposons, for example, gets very robustly and very dramatically reprogrammed every generation. So first in the early embryo, from the zygote to the pre-implantation embryo, there is a wave of demethylation where transposons lose all their methylation, which is then restored, remarkably, in the early embryo, only to be lost again in the germline, in the primordial germ cells during later embryogenesis. And these two waves of demethylation essentially wipe out epigenetic inheritance. Now, they don't wipe out all epigenetic inheritance. Importantly, that particular class of transposon I introduced at the beginning, these IAP retrotransposons in the mouse, actually stay methylated, at least during one of those waves of reprogramming. And perhaps that's why that one example of IAP controlling agouti does have a transgenerational component. And I think it's reasonably well demonstrated by the great Emma Whitelaw. That is true. But it's literally the only example, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but that's really been defined molecularly to be inherited from one generation to the next. And it's probably because of this failure of reprogramming. Okay, so given that reprogramming is so important in the life history of transposons, we set out a few years ago to find out what it was about plants that made them special. And so we looked in the plant germline to see whether plants genomes also and plant transposons also undergo reprogramming. The plant germline is actually very easy to harvest. You can just wipe it off the boot of your car. No, not quite that easy. But importantly, it's important to know that there are two cell types in pollen, so they're not single cells. This is for flowering plants. There's a cell type labeled in red here called the vegetative nucleus, which is like a companion cell or a nurse cell. It supports the growth of the pollen tube, but it doesn't give its DNA to the next generation. And then there are two sperm cells. I'm not going to explain why there are two sperm cells. It's actually very interesting and epigenetic. But there are two sperm cells, which engage in double fertilization and do contribute their DNA to the next generation. Okay, so in terms of reprogramming, what are we looking at? We're looking at the full suite of epigenetic marks. Plants have pretty much all of everything that there is to offer. DNA methylation, of course. Plants have very heavily methylated genomes. Histone modification and histone variants. We've done a lot of work with this, but I'm not gonna tell you anything about it at all. I'm gonna focus instead on DNA methylation and small regulatory RNA. So this is a very important way of regulating transposons through the process of RNA interference. Just to introduce you to how that works in plants, there are multiple classes of small RNAs in plants, much as there are in animals. They're slightly different though. We don't have pi RNAs, for example, they don't exist in plants, but we think there are things that do a very similar job, as you'll see in a moment. There are two very broad classes of plant small RNAs. There are those that are derived from single-stranded fold-back precursors, the most famous of which are, of course, microRNAs. In plants, these can be between 21 and 22, typically, sometimes larger. And of course, these target genes. That means they have very important developmental roles and typically very, very major phenotypes if you were to mess with them. But then the other class is derived from double-stranded RNA, which requires RNA-dependent RNA polymerase to make the double-stranded RNA. And by far the most abundant of these are 24 nucleotides in size, and these come specifically from transposons. They can also come from things like satellite repeats. So they're found throughout the heterochromatic part of the genome. There's another class which is much, in Arabidopsis, is much smaller, 21 nucleotides in size, and there's only about maybe half a dozen loci that give rise to these, so much, much less than the thousands and thousands of transposons. And these are called sometimes transacting small interfering RNA because they also target genes and they can also be very important phenotypically. And they're made from non-coding RNA precursors. Okay, so these are the three classes then, major classes of small RNAs known in plants. The 24 nucleotide heterochromatin small RNA, you can map these by sequencing back to the genome. And when you do that, they map very nicely to regions of heterochromatin. For example, this small interstitial region of heterochromatin on chromosome 4 is really full of these small RNAs. And they map specifically to the red and green boxes here, which are transposable elements, and much less to the genes, which are in yellow. That doesn't mean there are no genes that have them. There are some. But by far the majority of these 24 nucleotide small RNAs come from transposons. So given that, you might expect that if you were to take these 24 nucleotide small RNAs away, for example, by making a mutation, you might have a dramatic effect on transposon activity in Arabidopsis. And very disappointingly, this experiment has been done multiple times, and very little happens. There's maybe 100 or 200 transposons that come on when you remove these small RNAs, but hundreds of thousands of other transposons stay silent. And the reason for that is that these small RNAs, these 24 nucleotide small RNAs, silence transposons through DNA methylation. And this is the work from many, many labs over the last 20 years or so, through a very complicated mechanism that I'm not going to get into. It's plant specific in any great detail. Anyway, you start with RNA transcripts that come from the chromosome, from the transposon, but they're made by a very specific RNA polymerase, POL4 it's called. This then gets converted into double-stranded RNA by the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, and then into the small RNAs by DICER. It gets loaded onto another polymerase, amazingly enough, which then recognizes a DNA methyltransferase and puts DNA methylation on the DNA. So what is the effect of this is that the small RNA is essentially guiding, by virtue of its sequence, to the DNA methyltransferase to a cytosine that corresponds to that sequence. So that means any cytosine, in principle, can be methylated by this mechanism. But as I said, if you were to take any one of these proteins away, remarkably enough, transposons stay methylated. And the reason for that is that you can maintain DNA methylation in plants as well as in animals by means that don't require RNA. And this, of course, has to be written into the sequence. It has to be DNA dependent in some way. And so the places where you can maintain DNA methylation without RNA guides have a symmetric sequence. It reads the same on one strand, on the Watson strand, as it does on the Crick strand. So CG would read CG on the other strand. CHG, where H is anything but G, would also read CHG on the other strand. And these are maintained either by replication or by chromatin. I'm not going to get into details anymore, but not by RNAi. And that means that when you lose RNAi, transposons by and large stay methylated because they retain this type of DNA methylation. All right, so what happens when you lose that DNA methylation? So many years ago, I collaborated with Eric Richards back at Cold Spring Harbor to isolate mutants in DNA methylation in our model plant here, Arabidopsis thaliana. We did it in those days by southern blotting, something that nobody knows how to do anymore. I do too, but no one in my lab knows how to do anymore. But southern blotting can be used as a screen because, and we use repetitive DNA because that way we could pool many, many plants together and identify rare individuals with mutations. And when we did that, we came up with two complementation groups, which Eric went on to clone, DDM1 for decrease in DNA methylation 1 and DDM2. DDM2 turned out to encode the DNA methyltransferase that's required for this CG type of DNA methylation. Let's go back for a minute. That's this methyltransferase here. It works at the replication fork to put CG back where it should be. It's very, very faithful, and this was no big surprise. DDM1, however, did not encode a DNA methyltransferase. It encodes a chromatin remodeler, SWI2-SNF2 class ATPase, for those of you who know what that means. There's also a very good homologue of this in mammals called LSH1. It seems to do exactly the same thing as it does in plants. And this is quite an interesting mutation because it really only affects heterochromatin. It only affects transposons and repeats and has essentially no effect on genes. In fact, if it has any effect on genes, it's the opposite. And so now we have these mutations that really do lose DNA methylation in plants, and sure enough, transposons and repeats are very, very strongly expressed in these mutants. And you might imagine that this would be very bad news for the plant, as it is in animals. So in animals, mutations in the orthologs, DNMT1 in the mouse, LSH1 in the mouse, result in embryonic or perinatal lethality. And this is very robust and very reproducible, and it's thought to be largely because of problems with transposons. But that's not true in Arabidopsis. So we wanted to know, figure out why. We suspected it might be something to do with small RNAs. And so Zach, when he was in the lab, did this northern blot. Again, nobody does these anymore either. I'm going to stop signing out in a minute. But the transposons, he used four different transposons, an LTR retrotransposon, a non-LTR retrotransposon, another LTR, and a DNA transposon, so all the major classes, and found that the 24 nucleotide small RNAs, if anything, go down in these mutants in general, and that sort of makes sense. You've got less methylation, so maybe you'd have less small RNAs. But one particular small RNA class from some transposons went up. In fact, it appeared out of nowhere. These 21 nucleotide small RNAs were only found in MET1 and DDM1 mutants, not in other types of mutants that lose other types of DNA methylation. And they were so strong, we called them epigenetically activated or easy RNAs. And these are 21 nucleotides in size instead of 24. We thought, wow, maybe this is what's keeping these plants alive. And so Keith Slotkin, when he was in the lab, made double mutants now between DDM1 and all of the known RNAi genes, all those genes in that big complicated model, and figured out which ones were required for the production of these easy RNAs by northern blotting. And I'm not going to show you any of that data, but this is the result. He found that there was one specific argonaut, actually two different dices, only one of which is shown here, and one specific RDRP that were required. RDR6, DCL4, and AGO1. And interestingly, these are exactly the same RNAi genes as are required to make those TASI RNAs, the 21 nucleotide transacting small RNAs I told you about before. But there's only half a dozen non-coding RNAs that make these things. Now, a huge number of transposons, we estimate around 2,000 transposons in the Arabidopsis genome, are now making this class of small RNA in a DDM1 mutant. So that's very profound, and it leads us to suspect that maybe this pathway is more ancient than we think. And now, of course, we're able to answer the question that we set out to: what do the double mutants look like? If these RNAs are keeping the plants alive, then surely the double mutants are going to look weird, and they do. DDM1, RDR6, double mutants have very severe, very pleiotropic phenotypes. And until very recently, we had no idea what these were. So for those of you who have been following this story, this is the new bit. So this reminded our collaborator, Tetsuji Kagetani, and my postdoc, Atsushi Shimada, who actually started in Tetsuji's lab. This reminded him of chromosome segregation phenotypes. So if you can't segregate your chromosomes properly, for example, if you lose centromeric histones, then you end up with phenotypes very much like this. He was able to use a trick from Vincent Collot, which is epigenetic mapping of epigenetic traits in a background that has no polymorphisms, right? So the sequence is identical, but the methylation itself can allow you to map traits. And so he used this crossing scheme to identify which regions of the chromosomes that are getting unmethylated in DDM1 are causing this phenotype in an RDR6 mutant background. And he ended up being able to map it, unfortunately, to a very large region of chromosome 5 surrounding the centromere. So the centromeres don't recombine very well. And so this was a problem. But it was the centromere, remarkably enough. And then I'm not going to show you all the detail, he did a suppressor screen where he tried to revert the phenotype and successfully reverted it amazingly enough by reverting the methylation, and was able to map it using independent revertance to a single transposon, an LTR retrotransposon that's in the centromere of chromosome 5. And sure enough, when you do these just dappy-stained anaphases in normal plants, or in DDM1 mutants for that matter, you see perfectly normal segregation. But in DDM1 RDR6 mutants, you see lagging chromosomes, which will remind the Pombe geneticists among the audience of something very similar in Pombe, and actually other aberrations as well. This occurs at a very high frequency, and it occurs almost exclusively to chromosome 5. So in fact, the phenotype that we're seeing is due to the role of transposons and the role of small RNAs in centromere function. So that's a new story. Okay, but given these easy RNAs are extremely important, why are they only from transposons? What is it about transposons that's triggering these easy RNAs? Obviously, if you triggered them from every gene in the genome, this would be very bad news. You'd silence every gene in the genome and you'd be very dead. So something must be targeting these very specifically. We knew where to look because TASI RNAs, transacting small RNAs, are triggered by microRNAs. So microRNAs start the process by recognizing a transcript. It's not just any old microRNA. You have to have a special pattern of at least two microRNAs of 21 nucleotides or one of 22 nucleotides, a detail you don't have to remember. But it's a very specific type of targeting, and this is what makes TASI RNAs. So we suspected that transposons might also be targeted in DDM1 mutants by micros, and in fact they are. So here's that Attila transposon again, and this is now using a technique called PairSeq, which is a way of sequencing the degradome. It's a way of identifying cleavage sites in RNA throughout the whole genome by sequencing. And we are able to identify these cleavage sites and line them up with microRNAs. And sure enough, about 50 different microRNAs target about 2,000 different transposons. So it's extremely common. This is just a couple of examples where multiple hits of these two microRNAs trigger these 21 nucleotide small RNAs from this Attila class of transposon, the very same class that's sitting at the centromere in those mutants. This was quite remarkable. I mean, no one had thought that micros target transposons, and I should say microRNAs target more transposons a lot more than they do genes in plants, as if they really evolve as a transposon monitoring system. And since this was published a few years ago, similar microRNAs have been found in many other organisms, including humans, that target, for example, L1s. And so this is probably quite a general mechanism. Given that, you might expect that it should be working at some point in normal development and not just in DDM1 mutants. So Keith looked for transposon expression then in wild-type plants. He did this using information on the internet. So this is genome genome databases, and he found that transposons were silent throughout most of plant development. So in leaves and so on, they really are quite silent in Arabidopsis, but they come on twice, in pollen and in immature seed. This is, of course, exactly the wrong place for transposons to come on. It's in the germline. Surely, that's if you can keep them silent, why is that happening in the germline? Well, it turns out that it's happening very specifically, at least in pollen, in just one of the two cell types. So this is a dappy-stained pollen grain. Here are the two sperm cells. You can see they have very highly condensed DNA. But the DNA in the vegetative nucleus has essentially lost all of its heterochromatin. It's unraveled. And that correlates quite nicely with the expression of DDM1 itself. So DDM1 is expressed very strongly in sperm nuclei, but not really in the vegetative nucleus. And so this is where transposons are coming on. They're coming on in the vegetative nucleus, in the pollen grain, but not in the sperm cells themselves. And I'm not going to show you any data. We published this a little while ago, and Keith Slotkin has his own lab in Ohio State University. He just had a beautiful paper in Nature Plant demonstrating this really does happen. So it was a model at the time, but now it looks better. So in the vegetative nucleus then, we're losing DDM1 and reactivating transposons. These are getting turned into small RNAs, and these are ending up in the sperm cell nuclei. Now, you may be wondering why this happens. What it is really is the plant is fooling the transposons into exposing themselves at a very sensitive moment in reproduction, exposing themselves in such a way that they'll generate the small RNAs that will silence the very same transposons in the neighboring germline. So it's a very clever way of identifying just those transposons that can make transcripts and just those that can that make small RNAs. You might be wondering what sort of microRNA is responsible for targeting these transposons. This is also a new piece, whether you follow this. Well, it turns out pollen has a unique microRNA. It's called microRNA 845 in Arabidopsis. It's conserved in all plants that have pollen. And it specifically targets retrotransposons. It actually targets the primer binding site of retrotransposons, which means the retrotransposon needs this sequence. It cannot mutate out of it. And so it will never escape from this type of silencing. It works on copias as well as gypsies. There are interesting and subtle differences I don't have time to tell you, very interesting differences actually. But as a result, this single microRNA targets almost all, and certainly all the potentially active retrotransposons in the pollen. So it's amazing. And you can make reporter genes and so on. There's really a lot of it. It's by far the most abundant microRNA in pollen. It's like 80,000 reads or something up there. Really remarkably, to my mind, it's polymorphic in Arabidopsis. This is weird. So the normal workhorse wild type, Columbia, has it, and that means this sensor is silenced in pollen. But this accession of Arabidopsis called Landsberg's, very widely used, doesn't have it. And in fact, we know why from the genome sequence. It's deleted one copy and mutated the other. So it's a very specific loss. And we're still trying to figure out exactly why that is. We have some ideas that, as you might imagine, involve chromosome behavior and possibly some sort of speciation based on that sort of chromosome behavior. But we're still trying to figure that out. But it's amazing that it's so highly conserved in other plants, but it can disappear from Arabidopsis. Okay, so small RNAs then, very important in reprogramming of the pollen and of regulating transposons. What happens to DNA methylation in pollen? So to figure that out, we figured out how to purify, this was Joe Colarco and Philippe Bourges, figured out how to purify microspores on the one hand. These are the products of meiosis, these are haploid. These then divide twice to give you that vegetative cell and a generative cell and then the two sperm cells. And we were able to purify the two sperm cells, the vegetative nucleus and the microspore in sufficient quantities to do DNA methylation sequencing. This is what that looked like. I just want to remind you that plants have methylation, cytosine methylation in all sequence contexts. You have the symmetric ones that can be replicated without RNAi, and then the asymmetric ones which need RNAi. And I'm not going to, you know, blow this up for you yet. You can see quite obviously that there's not much going on. Okay. So there's lots of DNA methylation at the centromere, but it doesn't really change much in those three cell types, at least not in the symmetric context. And although initially disappointing, we realized quickly that this might explain why epigenetic inheritance happens in plants, but not in mammals. Because in mammals, if you did a similar experiment, you'd see plummeting DNA methylation in the germline and in the embryo. And we see the opposite here. And that could be why epigenetic inheritance mediated by transposons can be inherited more in plants than in animals. Of course, there's no real way to test that. But it is an interesting theory. But having said that, there are some changes, and there are some important changes in RNA-guided DNA methylation. So this is methylation that cannot be maintained independently of RNAi. We call that CHH, because H is anything but G. And you can see that in, actually you can't see probably, but in microspores and in sperm cells, we have pretty dramatically reduced CHH methylation compared to the vegetative nucleus. And in fact, if we now compare this data to published data from other tissues, we can see that, in fact, the microspore has very little CHH methylation. Sperm cells have even less compared with, for example, most somatic tissues. But it comes back, and it comes back dramatically in the embryo. So after fertilization, it comes back. Now, this is looking a lot like reprogramming. So we're losing DNA methylation in the germline, but then getting it back after fertilization. And we think that this is coming back through, of course, RNAi. It pretty much has to, because it's this type of DNA methylation. Okay, so we can demonstrate that in another way. This is also taken from that paper. You can do something called DMR analysis, differentially methylated regions in the computer, and we could find something like 2,000 transposons that were differentially methylated in this very specific sequence context, CHH methylation between sperm cells and everything else, and microspores. This compared to very little change, though actually quite important change in CG methylation, I don't have time to tell you about, but much less than CHH methylation. Okay, so this led to the following model then. We think that the microspore maintains CG methylation, which is maintained throughout into the sperm cells. There's a little bit of loss of CG methylation that occurs in the vegetative nucleus, possibly because DDM1's not there, but also through the action of demethylase, as it turns out. I don't have time to tell you about that, but it is quite interesting. Retrotransposons do the opposite with respect to CHH methylation, which is lost precipitously in the microspore, and then is maintained very low in the germline, in the sperm cells. It actually goes back up again, amazingly enough, in the vegetative mucus, but it's maintained very low, and then comes back again in the embryo after fertilization. All right, so what happens then if you skip this reprogramming altogether? Now, you can do that. You can do that in plants. You can also now do it in animals through the wonders of stem cell biology. You can take a somatic cell, a skin cell, and you can make it into a stem cell, which could potentially make a whole embryo. And for example, in farm animal cloning, people are beginning to do this. This has been around for a really long time in plants. Ask any wine grower, and he will tell you, or she will tell you, how proud they are of their clones. So Pinot Noir hasn't actually had sex since the late 13th century because it is all the same clone. And interestingly, those clones are different from each other, as any wine grower or any grape biologist will tell you. They're quite different, and they're different because of epigenetic differences and transposon differences between the different clones. In fact, transposons are responsible for more of the important variation in wine. For example, the difference between red and white wine is because of a transposon. And transposons are really responsible for a lot of differences in these clones. So what happens then when you clone plants in this case? So Arabidopsis, you can put into cell culture. These cell cultures are diploid. They can grow forever. The one we're using has been around for at least 30 years. It hasn't lost any chromosomes as far as we can tell. So we did some methylation profiling, and sure enough, transposons, very specific transposons, the very same transposons that respond in pollen to small RNAs, also lose DNA methylation in these cell cultures. What even more remarkable, they lose DNA methylation in a non-CG context. So I'm comparing here pollen methylation levels in CG, CHG, and CHH contexts with leaf and with these suspension cells. And you can see that the blue and black bars here, this non-CG methylation, is dramatically lost from cell culture, and very specifically. So we wondered if this was also guided by small RNAs, and it appears that it is. We see the same shift in small RNAs. I'm not going to explain all the detail here, but the same shift as we do in pollen, as we do in DDM1. So these are easy RNAs. If you look at the red line here, compare it to the green line. The green line is normal somatic cells, leaves, but the red line is what happens in cell culture, and we see this really dramatic shift from 24 to 21 in size. And again, specifically for the transposons that can be targeted by microRNAs and which make these easy RNAs. So it's the same set of transposons. So you wonder then what happens if you try to make clonal plants from this without fertilization, because fertilization would normally be the way to restore that DNA methylation. And this is not a trivial or academic question because people do it a lot, so I'm going to skip over all that. So in fact, micropropagation from cell culture is widely used in agriculture. It's used by plant breeders to make specific types of plants, but it's also used, especially in tropical plantation crops, to actually make the crops themselves. And the reason for this is that breeding of these crops has been very slow. It takes a long time. These are relatively new crops. And so the quickest way to get a high producing elite hybrid palm is to find the one you like the most by measuring its yield. So these are adult trees where you can actually measure the yield of oil. Put that into culture and then generate literally tens of thousands of genetically identical clones. It's like something out of Star Wars. And these genetically identical clones all have the elite characteristics, the elite genetic characteristics of the initial palm. So this is the perfect way, surely, to do oil palm, in this case, breeding. But in fact, just like Dolly the sheep, and just like all other, or just like Pinot Noir, the clones are not identical, and you get epigenetic variation in these clones. So much so that when Unilever first developed the cloning procedure back in the 1970s, they were very excited about it. They invested a lot of money, but the very first plantation they planted out, 10 years after the cloning step, they were able to see fruit, and instead of seeing fruit like that, they saw fruit like this. This is a very dramatic homeotic mutation that completely wipes out oil yield. It's actually parthenocarpic, so it doesn't undergo fertilization and doesn't make a seed, and it's very, very bad news. It's a phenotype that's called mantled. Very specific. It happens at a variable frequency. The very first plantation had almost 100%. But now it can be much lower, maybe 5% or 10%. But nonetheless, it's enough to completely dissuade, especially anyone except for a big company that can afford the risk, to use cloning. This phenotype is very specific, and as I said, it's homeotic. So what that means is that the stamens have been transformed into carpels. So it has a very specific phenotype that very closely resembles what are called B-class mutations in plants. Deficiens was the first one to be identified in Antirrhinum many years ago. Apetalar 3, it's called, in Arabidopsis. It has a very, very similar phenotype. And so this gene, Deficiens, was always thought of as an extremely good candidate for what might be causing mantling, but no one was ever able to show that there was a mutation, transposon, or anything like that in the gene. So we set about using what I call epigenome-wide association studies. So this is instead of looking for DNA variation, we're looking for methylation variation from one plant to the next. We used a very nice material. So this, I should say, we in this case, is in full disclosure, a company that I'm associated with, RN Genomics, a Cold Spring Harbor spin-off company, and extremely importantly, the Malaysian government. This is the Malaysian government research arm called the Malaysian Oil Palm Board. And they were able to obtain samples from trios. These are epigenetic trios, where the clones that come from this elite hybrid palm all have the same genotype, and they have the same genotype as the parent. So these three should theoretically be identical genetically. So any difference you find epigenetically must be due to an epigenetic change in tissue culture. And sure enough, we found thousands of such changes in these trios. But after looking at hundreds and hundreds of trios, we could then identify literally a single methylated feature that's always unmethylated in mantled palms and always methylated in wild type palms. And it maps here on chromosome 12. What was really really amazing about it was that it was a transposon. Well, of course we knew it would be, but it was a transposon. This is something that you may be familiar with if you do genome-wide association studies. It's just a Manhattan plot. And you can see that, in fact, there were four features that were statistically significant in the genome. They all mapped to the same transposon, and one of them, right at the end of the transposon here, was the most significant. This transposon was sitting right in the middle of the deficiency gene, so this made a huge amount of sense. It totally explained, or began to explain, the phenotype. The other thing that was very interesting was the name of the transposon. The transposon had been found before in other plants. It had been found first in rice, and it had been called karma. I didn't make that up. It's actually true. So the reason it had been called karma is because this group in Japan had identified it in rice tissue culture. And what was really interesting was that it only came on and only started to move around after you regenerated plants from the tissue culture. And that's why they called it karma, because it affected the next generation. Okay. And in fact, that is exactly what we think is going on here. What we see at the karma element is loss of DNA methylation. And remarkably, it's only loss of non-CG methylation, just like we saw in Arabidopsis tissue culture. CG methylation looks perfectly fine, but non-CG methylation is basically missing from the karma transposon. Of course, this also allowed us to name the epialleles. Oh, hang on. First of all, let me show you this. In order to prove that you have the right thing, it's not good enough to just have many, many examples of it happening. You really, in epigenetics, have to revert it. And this can happen. So some very rare mantle trees recover from the disease, from the phenotype, if you like, and they recover because they get remethylated. We're not quite sure how that happens, but it does. And we had two of these revertants, and here they are. They both regain methylation, whereas those that don't revert do not regain methylation. So it looks like this was the formal proof that the karma element was really responsible for the phenotype. But this allowed us then to name the two epialleles, right? We have the wild-type epiallele, which is methylated, which we call good karma, and the unmethylated allele, which we call bad karma. And it turned out that bad karma, the unmethylated allele, resulted in a splicing defect. So it's sitting in the intron, this huge intron. It's about 40 kb, which is really big for a plant intron. It's the biggest I've ever seen, actually. The karma element is sitting close to this exon. And what happens when it gets unmethylated is you get splicing between this exon and this exon. That may sound weird that splicing is controlled by DNA methylation, but actually it is. It is in humans as well. There's several papers on it. And in plants, we were able to show in the maize methylome, for example, that there's a really close correlation between methylation and splicing, or failure to splice. So it inhibits splicing. So it does make sense, but we still don't know what the mechanism is. We could talk about that. But interestingly, these mis-spliced dominant negative transcripts appear at exactly the stage of fruit development that they would need to in order to make the homeotic transformation that we observe. Small RNAs, you may be wondering. Sure enough, the small RNAs are there, 24 nucleotide small RNAs in wild type, in the shoot marrow. Think of a heart of palm, if you like, from which all these leaves are coming. And we see lots of these 24 nucleotide small RNAs. In mantled palms, there are much fewer. And in tissue culture, whether it's normal or mantled, derived from a normal or a mantled palm, you see very few, if any at all. So again, it's the loss of these 24 nucleotide small RNAs in tissue culture that seems to be causing the problem. And indeed, we see, again, this shift, even in oil palm, which is not related in any way to Arabidopsis. These are very, very different plants. We see this shift from 24 nucleotide small RNAs found in inflorescences or in the heart of palm to 21s in tissue culture. So once again, there's something to do if you undergo that first step of reprogramming, but don't restore the small RNAs by fertilization, then you're going to run into these epigenetic problems. So this also led to my So very importantly, and the reason the Malaysian oil palm bulb were interested in this, what this allows you to do is predict whether a cloned palm will have mantle fruit or not. And this is really important because what tends to happen in Malaysia and Indonesia, as everybody knows, oil palm is an extremely controversial crop. And in part that's because smallholders, when they have a bad year, for example, if they discover that all their oil palm trees are mantled, are very tempted, because they can't really afford to do anything else, to burn down the neighboring rainforest and replant a bunch of oil palms there. And this is what's really made it very difficult for cloned palms to actually enter the market, because there's a big risk associated with them. But now we can take a very simple DNA test, either a restriction enzyme test, which this rather complicated graph does, which separates mantle from normal extremely well, or if you really want to be accurate about it, bisulfite sequencing, and literally the sequence of that feature, there's a single cytosine. So if you think about it, splice acceptor sites are CAG, and so the cytosine on the other strand of that G at the splice acceptor is a 100% predictor of mantle. It's amazing. So there's a few other sites around there too, which are almost as good. So it's probably just a bit of coincidence. But anyway, it is amazing. And we're hoping that that will help then in maintaining the very important ban that currently exists on additional consummation of consuming of rainforests. This is a picture taken by my co-author and colleague, Melina Ong Abdullah, who's at the Malaysian Oil Palm Bowl. She got into a helicopter and went up above Borneo here. This is the province of Sarawak. And on the left is the oldest rainforest on Earth. It's thought to be 100 million years since it was underwater. On the right is an oil palm plantation. And you can just see the dramatic effect that this is having. It also led to my favorite nature cover of all time, Weed Out Bad Karma. It was not my idea. That was the editor, but that's the idea. Okay, so just to summarize quickly, easy RNAs are triggered by micros that target active transposons, and active transposons happen in normal plants in pollen in order to make these easy RNAs, which end up in the sperm. However, not much change in DNA methylation happens in the plant germline, which is probably why we get epigenetic inheritance. But the bit that does is in fact important. It's probably more important in other plants than it is in Arabidopsis. And if you don't regain the CHH methylation that's reprogrammed in pollen by fertilization, then you can get these epigenetic problems, which are clearly controlled by small RNAs. And finally, I like to make this point, especially to funding agencies. These are real-world consequences of epigenetics. Epigenetics is not just in our imagination. It really is doing something out there and very important for agriculture. But I'd also like to add that we would know absolutely nothing about the deficiency gene, the karma transposon, or DNA methylation small RNA if we haven't studied model organisms like Arabidopsis or maize. And without that, we would never have found karma, and we'd never be in a position to actually fix this very important trait. Very important to acknowledge people in the lab. So very sadly, the late Joe Colarco, my graduate student who moved to Stanford, but very sadly died last year, was responsible really for getting that pollen methylome worked out with Philippe Bourges. And our collaborators in Portugal, who were in Portugal at the time, José Feijóo and Jörg Becker. And then Milos did all the original work on cell culture and Arabidopsis. Since then, Philippe's done a lot of that. Kate Creasy did the sequencing of the pair sequencing of microRNAs targeting transposons. Keith, I think I told you a lot about what Keith's been up to, and here are the Malaysians. And in fact, I just want to finish with a picture of our Malaysian collaborators. Here they are. This is Maylina here, who took that picture and is in charge of tissue culture, and her boss, who really deserves a lot of credit here, Ravi Sambathamurthy, who was the director at the time of biotechnology at MPOB. So thanks. I'll take some questions.